Now, in spite of reports saying today would be Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's last day on the job, he's apparently sticking around for at least a few more days. Last week, the New York Times had reported that Rosenstein had proposed wearing a wire to record President Trump. It also said he discussed invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office. But Rosenstein called the story inaccurate and factually incorrect and said there's no basis to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove the president. This morning, new reports surfaced saying that Rosenstein was going to resign. Other reports said he was on his way to the White House and expected to be fired. Then White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders put out a statement saying that Rosenstein and Trump will meet on Thursday when Trump is back in Washington. So what's going on? Daniel Lipman is a reporter for Politico and a co-author of Politico's Playbook newsletter. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as of this moment, Dan, our understanding is that Rosenstein was the Deputy Attorney General and, as of now, still is, right?
He is. He still has that job, at least for the next couple days. Going to meet with Trump on Thursday, and then it's kind of like the showdown at the OK Corral, where we'll have to see if what happens, because Trump has attacked Rosenstein in the past. Rosenstein has given many indications that he won't bend to political pressure, and also it doesn't look like he's going to resign willingly. He wants to get pushed out if he is going to leave his job. He doesn't want to look like he's a coward and can't take the heat.
Now, ordinarily, a deputy attorney general, it's an important job, but we wouldn't be focusing on it this much. But because Attorney General Sessions recused himself from the Mueller probe, or from the Russia investigation, which became the Mueller probe, Rod Rosenstein is really a key figure between the White House and Robert Mueller, right?
He is. He's crucial to overseeing the Mueller investigation, approving their requests for more money and staff, and also kind of making sure that Mueller doesn't go beyond his remit. I don't know how long, how often that Mueller talks to Rosenstein, but they seem to have a good relationship. Rosenstein has worked in the Department of Justice for around 20 years. He started as a lawyer in the public integrity section. And so he takes his job very seriously in terms of protecting DOJ's credibility. He knows that his personal reputation is at stake as well.
Now, Rosenstein and Mueller, you say, have had a decent relationship. Rosenstein and President Trump have not. Can you talk about what the president has had to say about Rod Rosenstein even before last week's New York Times piece?
So he's accused him of being a Democrat from Baltimore when, in fact, Rosenstein is a registered Republican. He has said that, Rosenstein is biased when that, we don't have any evidence that that's the case as well. He has also gone after Rosenstein for approving or playing a role in that FISA warrant, signing off on one of his first surveillance a couple of years ago. Trump did not want anyone associated with his campaign getting surveilled, and so he's taken that as a personal affront. When in fact, if you look at the surveillance documents, the limited portions that we have access to, they don't talk all about the dossier that Trump loves to say formed the basis of the Trump investigation. It's more about they were looking at things that were long concerns for the FBI and the justice community. It was not just because of that controversial dossier that Christopher Steele made. But that's given Trump license to go after Rosenstein, especially with that report last Friday by the New York Times that Rosenstein thought about taping Trump and also considered invoking the 25th Amendment to get the cabinet to throw Trump out of office. But those reports, while the New York Times is one of the best papers in the world, this is a complex power play between Trump, Rosenstein, and a guy named Andrew McCabe, who was also part of the DOJ and an FBI, who was a top FBI official who was tangled with Rosenstein over a number of issues. And Rosenstein, of course, he wrote that memo that pushed Comey out, and McCabe and Comey were close.
We are talking about the latest on Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General, rumors back and forth this morning that he might be out of a job. Well, he's not, at least not yet. A meeting between Rosenstein and the president scheduled, the White House says, for Thursday. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the news that Rosenstein may be on the way out? Do you think Trump should fire him or force him to resign, or should he stay on the job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion now about Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and whether his exit from the Justice Department might be around the corner. Daniel Lipman is a reporter for Politico and co-author of Politico's Playbook newsletter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Rosenstein stay on the job, or would you rather see him fired or resign? What would it all say? What would his departure say about the Russia investigation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls. Ray is with us in Wausau. Ray, hello.
Oh.
Ray, hi. What do you think? Okay, Ray's gone. Daniel Lipman, let's get back to what Rosenstein's departure might mean for the Russia investigation. I think Ray wanted to bring up that issue, so let's go there. What are the hopes and fears if he's not there?
Well, there are not that many hopes, but the fears would be that the next person, which would probably be Noel Francisco, who actually worked for the law firm Jones Day that did Trump campaign work, legal work, that he would oversee the investigation, would not do a very good job on that, and he might tilt the scales and prevent Mueller from continuing his work properly. And he's seen as more of a partisan lawyer than Rod Rosenstein, and he's less immune to the political forces. He's closer to the White House than Rosenstein. What's interesting is that we had seen reports from the Wall Street Journal a couple months ago that Rosenstein and Trump had an excellent relationship, and I think they had put that out there to try to make everyone think that everything was just fine. But now we see these reports that everything is kind of dissolving into a chaos in that relationship.
Yeah, and that brought us to this morning where we heard conflicting reports from different news sources citing White House sources saying that Rosenstein had resigned, was about to resign, was going to the White House expecting to be fired. At least as of now, it turned out none of that was the case. What do you make of this barrage of White House sourced stories on Rosenstein's future?
It's kind of indicative of the misinformation that comes from the White House, where we don't know what's true and what's not. And I think so people in the White House also didn't know, unless they were senior, the principals, they know what's going on. But Trump, he and his aides rushed to Trump Tower when they were in New York to discuss this. And this is kind of a side story a little bit, because the Kavanaugh news is the main topic du jour in Washington this week, and trying to figure out what's going to happen to him, that's been dominating a lot of news coverage. And so, you know, who knew that Rosenstein would eventually, his time would come to an end, and I'm sure he will make a lot of money in the private sector if he ever leaves government.
And there's argument back and forth now. Well, is the Rosenstein story meant as a distraction from the Kavanaugh story? Or is the White House taking advantage of the Kavanaugh story as a distraction from the Rosenstein story?
Yeah, everyone's creating lots of distractions. And I think the Trump White House, they like the fact that Rosenstein is the top story instead of Kavanaugh today, but that's not going to be the case come Wednesday and Thursday. Thursday is looking to be an amazing day with the Kavanaugh hearings plus this blockbuster meeting with Trump and Rosenstein. So it's possible that Trump will reject the resignation and then they will patch things up. But you don't normally see these types of flare-ups in the presidential, in the presidency, where you have the deputy attorney general threaten to resign or get fired. That's just not how things work.
And what are you watching for between now and Thursday? Honestly, with either of these stories, the Rosenstein story or the Kavanaugh story, is there a shoe you're waiting to see if, when, and where it drops?
So to take the Kavanaugh story first, he and his wife are going on Fox News tonight, and he's going to be talking with Martha McCallum. And so we're going to... they're going to get interviewed, and we're going to have to see, how he does. Does he? There's talk that, of course, he would have to use a female interview. You don't want to get interviewed by, a big masculine male for this interview. That would go against the message they're trying to send. And in terms of Rosenstein, I think it's just a matter of him thinking about: does he want to stay in this administration? Does he want to continue facing fire, even? To protect the Mueller investigation? Do Democrats pressure him to stay in that job? And also, what do Republicans tell the White House? They say, keep this guy in there because, he's kind of a buffer, a check on everything. Or do they say, push him out, he's not loyal?
We'll leave it there for now. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dan Lipman, reporter for Politico and co-author of Politico's Playbook newsletter. We talked with him today about the uncertain future of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. College is a great time to join some clubs, discover new hobbies, and maybe produce an album, write and star in your own play. For a group of UW-Madison students, that's what college looks like. The First Wave Scholarship Program is for students who are interested in being a part of a high-level artistic community, exploring different urban arts, and showcasing their talents. It's so unique that our Wisconsin Public Television colleagues have spent the last few years working on a documentary all about these students. Jalarina Sanders is a graduate of UW-Madison, originally from Tampa, Florida. She's a musician, writer, and playwright. Tiffany Ike is a UW-Madison student from Houston, Texas, also artist, writer, and playwright. They're both First Wave Scholars. And Trevor Keller is a producer for Wisconsin Public Television's Wisconsin Life, also produced the new documentary called Hip Hop U, which premieres tonight. We talked to the three of them last week about the documentary and about the program. Jalarina, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Glad to be here.
And Tiffany, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thank you. Yeah.
And Trevor, welcome. Thanks for coming to this side of the building.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, I want to talk to both of you as the students in this program. It's pretty new and different. Jalarina, what was it about the First Wave program that caught your attention?
Yeah, so I actually went to a festival when I was a young person called Brave New Voices, and First Wave performed there as sort of a featured act. And so I guess what caught my eye was their performance, them putting on what they had been working on as students of the program. And then at the end, they said, hey, we have the scholarship and we're in college, and if you want to do this, you should apply.
And Tiffany, what's it like for you having like art and music integrated into the normal part of college?
I was actually just talking about this the other day on how like people don't live the life that we do, like in terms of like we'll be in the middle of work and just break out into song, and that's like a normal occurrence. And as like a I was an athlete in high school, so it was kind of like, I guess all of that was pent up, and then I kind of was able to really enjoy just how fun like friends and things like that could be.
Well, Trevor, they're giving us a taste of it already, but what was it about the First Wave program that caught your eye and said, hey, these students are a great story for a documentary?
I think it's just the fact that there's not a program like this in the country. There's no program that brings in hip-hop artists on a scholarship, a full scholarship, to continue their studies at the college level. And so I think there were several people at Wisconsin Public Television who were aware of this program. We were all kind of aware of it. I think there was always kind of a feeling that this would make a great program for the documentary, for a documentary. And we had a producer, Megan Ailey, who was always a big champion. She worked with our Young Performers Initiative, and I know she was always really pushing for us to do a documentary on it. And so we were really glad that we finally had the opportunity to put something together.
Well, let's get a little feel for the program and take a listen to some of the students in the documentary talking about the experience.
I'm a graduate student. White people call me articulate all the time. I have locks. I rap all the time. Like, I'm a rapper. And that intersection of identities confuses and pleases people who have this understanding of hip hop that is warped.
Gravity won't bring me to the ground.
Dealing with all these things in a space that doesn't really understand you, I think that's where a lot of the challenges come in. And how do I explore, like, say, my blackness in this very white space? That's UW-Madison. And how do I bring my culture into this space? That's UW-Madison.
We have numbers. We have hearts. We have purpose. No one can take that away from us.
And Tiffany, let's talk about that. UW-Madison, largely white, as we heard in that clip there. How does this program kind of maybe bridge some gaps?
Okay, so I guess coming to Wisconsin was a very cultural shock for me. So being from Houston, which is like a very diverse area, just a lot of different kinds of people, a lot of different things to do, I think. Even though I lived in Houston, I actually probably learned more about like my blackness or who I am as a person being in this program, because a lot of these people in the program are really just, they really love their culture. They really love knowing about themselves. And it's like really important to express that, like just that ideology to others. And so I think that program is really, this program is really important to me, like myself, for somebody who just came from knowing a lot of diversity to actually getting to experience it within like art forms, to also just like a campus that is quite white. Yeah.
And Zalarina, what's it been like for you coming to a largely white campus through the lens of this program?
Yeah, it was weird. I felt black for the first time, I think. Like, and that's not to say I didn't know what I looked like or what my culture was, but it was not, I didn't feel so different from my peers. There were kids who looked like me and who didn't look like me, who had the same kind of upbringing and cared about the same things that I did when I was growing up. However, getting here, I was like a spot on something that was very, very white. Yeah. And people perceive that as a blemish. And I felt that.
Was this a common story you saw putting together the documentary, Trevor?
Yeah, absolutely. What we did is when we set out to do this documentary, we were obviously going to profile the students, show some of their performance work, be able to showcase the talent of these students. But we interviewed over a dozen students. We did probably 25 hours of interviews for this documentary. And I think it was a common theme that came up in the documentary. It was a lot of these students, they come from other places. There are students in First Wave from Wisconsin, but a lot of students come from outside Wisconsin. And for many of them, it is their first experience, like they spoke about, you know, just living in a place where it's just a less diverse place. And there are a lot of difficulties that come with that. And it was something that was pretty much across the board in every interview we did with a student of color for this program. And so I thought it was really important that we, you know, bring that voice to light and be able to talk about that a little bit, frankly, in the documentary.
Let's get into your experience as artists now. Let's take a listen to a little bit of Zalarina, again, from the documentary.
Ever since I was younger, people would be like, yo, sis, you gonna be my secret weapon, sis. They not expecting a woman to have this much flow and be this good. And I'm like, you're right, they're not. It doesn't seem like you expected it either. Women are in hip hop and we do it well. We do it really well. We do it better than a lot of other people.
Listen. I'm a Florida orange. I storm in the morning, perform with the chorus of horns. I was born in the corn. With a form that's quiet in the cold, but a swarm in the warm. Nappy roots, nappy roots, nappy roots. Three times in the mirror. Riding slow with my little cousin holding the car. Don't let my mixtape bang out your ears. Every other month is hurricane season. We both, we black, we ain't leave.
So that's a clip from your song Tampa about you and where you're from. What's it like for you to perform some of these pieces?
Tampa is one of my favorite songs, mainly because I get to celebrate this city that is not heard from a lot or represented a lot, I think, in hip hop outside of the city or outside of Florida. And so it's a lot of fun to tell people not only about my city, but to kind of interrupt that the Florida narrative that has been floating lately.
And then let's take a clip. Listen to a clip of one of your poems, Tiffany.
I don't think God would go to college. He is too major to settle in minor places. By no means, under no heavenly decree, would he elect to crash and burn under 10,000 degrees. Hell, does not recruit with pitchforks and tightrope. does not congregate in mobs at your front steps. It sits in your classroom, tells you to turn to unrepresentative textbooks, passes out invites to its kickbacks, and always makes sure to forget the back of the bus, college. When you find yourself parked in one, you learn more from the burning in your throat than the education taught in limbo.
Talk about creating poetry a little bit.
I started writing, so I always wanted to be a writer when I was a kid and things like that, but there was one year I couldn't do sports, and I was like, well, I got to do some type of competition, and so I entered Poetry Slams, so that's kind of how I got started, but I didn't really start writing about, like, myself and, like, what that actually, like, what it means to be who I am and just, like, kind of deeper poetry, I guess, I don't know, or just, like, delving into myself while using my craft until I got to college, and so I think perhaps that poem is more of an ode to it, as, like, I think I wrote that my sophomore year, and it was kind of when I started to step into, like, understanding how you can use the intersection of, like, art, activism, and talk about all those things, so...
When I look at artists from the past, a lot of times you know that one name, but then when you learn about them, you learn they're part of this community of people who interacted and inspired or maybe competed with each other. Shalarina, do you have that feeling like it's not just you, you're part of this community that's making each other better here?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was just speaking with a first waver who's like, yeah, you know, I came in with music and I just released a mixtape, but, you know, I think I'm going to get into filmmaking now. And, and because, like, I see other people doing it and it looks a lot of, like, it's a lot of fun. And I think First Wave not only encourages artist exploration, but it also encourages artist excellence. Like, yeah, we want to be good, and we admire, like, the cohorts that came before us, and we look up to them. And so, yeah, and when you think of, like, the Mos Defs, the Jill Scotts, they all kind of came from, like, these incubators, and First Wave is definitely one of those.
You're feeling that too, Tiffany. You're nodding along.
Yeah,
here.
Absolutely. I think what's really cool is, like, to all of us, like, within the group, we're all kind of normal, but, like, everybody else outside is like, wow, y'all are doing these great things. And I think sometimes we take it for granted about, like, I think me and a friend were talking and we had to, like, write up real quick, like, what we've done. And as we were writing, we're like, I was like, dang, you did that in high school? Like, and she's like, dang, you did that? And I'm just like, wow, we really do great things. And I think we almost think that it's just not, like, that's cool, yeah, but let's keep on going. Like, there's so much more we can do, and I think that's a really dope space to be in. Like, First Wave is definitely a place full of people who are, like, so awesome that we're, like, normal amongst each other, I guess. So,
yeah, we're hearing about exciting stuff here, Trevor. What are you hoping people who see the documentary take away from it?
I think it's just what you just talked about. Is, I think my co-producer on this project, Ryan Ward, and I, we have routinely said when we were doing this documentary, we're going to look back on this documentary in 10 years and see how all these students have gone off on their own separate ways, whether it's poetry or music or some other form of art, and they're going to be successful and people are going to know who they are, and we're going to have done this documentary about them, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, before they were a big name. And I think that's what people will see, the talent that this First Wave program brings to UW-Madison.
You're putting a lot of pressure on them here.
But I am, but they will get there. I know they will get there.
I want a question for each of you in turn to leave us with. Tiffany, what is something you've done or maybe about to do in this project that wouldn't have been on your radar before you started it?
Absolutely. almost everything. I don't know. I came in as a poet. Now I've sung in things. I am a playwright. I'm a director, not only of plays, but, like, films as well. So I think First Wave kind of gave me a platform to think that I could, like, I've always been like, oh, I could do these things. But now it's like, oh, I could do these things and actually make it happen regardless of, like, what name I have or just, like, how big I am. So I definitely have worked on, I think, being in this program actually kind of forced me to not, I was supposed to be a doctor when I came in, like, that was my goal. Now I'm hoping to be a filmmaker, like, and tell stories like that. So I think it definitely pushed me out of a comfort zone of, you know, stability and onto, like, a different kind of stability, like, inward and stuff like that. So,
and Jalarina, how about you?
Yeah. Man, a lot. I think, the biggest things in terms of taking new artistic plunges would definitely be with beat making and producing music, like the sound of it. I did a lot of, like, banging on tables growing up, but I never thought that I could create sounds that people would put to their music and or their lyrics. And then singing, which people mess with me a lot about because I claim to not
she
be
can
a singer.
Do it.
But singing and then playwriting. I've always kind of really enjoyed acting, but I never thought that I could create that work. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much. Looking forward to seeing the documentary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Jalarina Sanders and Tiffany Ike, UW-Madison students in the First Wave Scholars Program. Check out the documentary produced by Trevor Keller, who you heard there, along with Ryan Ward, tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Television. Find out more about the First Wave program and watch the documentary online at wpt4.org/hiphopu.